This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who aspire to be. If you're a real estate, mortgage, or financial professional, this is the place for you. We'll explore innovative investment analysis, sales, marketing, and income-generating strategies for the most historically proven wealth creator, income property. Learn from the experts as they show you how to build a better business and a better life.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who desire to be. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we talk about increasing your income, your productivity, and just generally having a better life while serving your clients better with America's most historically proven asset class, income property. We have a great interview for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds. It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Andrew Schiller to the show. He is the founder and CEO of Neighborhood Scout and Location Inc., and he's in the business of big data. We've all heard a lot about big data, and especially as it applies to real estate nationwide. So we're going to dive in and have an interesting discussion. Andrew, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Yeah, it's good to have you. So Location Inc. and Neighborhood Scout, I want to hear what you do, but you also have an interesting background. You're a geographer, is that correct?
It's absolutely true. In fact, I have a PhD in geography from the Graduate School of Geography at Clark University, which is a very old geography program, and I used to be a research scientist at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, which is a Department of Energy facility.
I don't think I've ever talked to anybody with a PhD in geography. I bet you could name every state capital.
My 11-year-old daughter can outdo me in that measure. Oh.
Well, so when you're a PhD in geography, I mean, you just look at a map all day. What do you do?
Right. Well, there's different streams in geography that people study. A lot of geographers are employed at the State Department and the CIA, and a lot of them do computer mapping and analysis and data. But generally, geography focuses on what creates place, what makes place different, and how do places evolve and change through time. My work was always in sustainable development, meeting the needs of the people today without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. And through that work, I got to be really detailed and exceptional at finding esoteric sources of data and using predictive models to kind of foretell the future.
Interesting, interesting. So, it sounds like it borders on certainly environmental stuff, sociology, and demographics too, right?
That's exactly right. Some people are more in the science side of it, hard science, like geomorphology, the shape of the Earth's crust and mountains and rivers. Some of them are more into remote sensing, imagery, satellite work, and meteorology. And others are more into the human environment side of it, including social and urban geography, which I place myself in.
And that's sort of like on the borders on city planning and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yep. There's subfields in economic geography, which a lot of people work in the real estate sector, and also in basically understanding risk assessment. And we did a lot of work in my doctorate work and since then in risk and understanding risk and trajectories of change for locations. It's not so much about whether a city or community is necessarily getting better or worse. It has more to do with how is it changing and what is it going to be like in the future. For example, could somebody say that Seattle, Washington is on its way to be more like Los Angeles or more like San Francisco or more like Denver? Which trajectory is it taking?
Mm-hmm. So when you say risk, though, what do you mean? Is that financial risk or crime rate risk or environmental risk? Or are you going to say all of the above?
It has sections of all of the above. Some of the work that we do has to focus on crime risk and predicting crime risk down to individual address level, 33-foot resolution crime risk data for the entire U.S., including Puerto Rico. It's one of our products, but we also look at financial risk. We have new indices that we're coming out with that help to identify information at the sub-zip code level on which neighborhoods are blue chip real estate investment opportunities versus those that are rising star, emerging markets, and also sinking ships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting. Well, okay. So, you know, we have a lot of real estate investors listening to the show. And if someone listening is not a real estate investor, I think you should be one because I believe it's the most historically proven asset class in the world. You know, it's got all these great multidimensional aspects from which to profit. But, you know, you can make mistakes, too. Nothing is without risk. You can help people maybe mitigate that risk with some of this data and knowledge that you have. Tell us how, you know, real estate investors might, you know, maybe use your services or just learn more from you.
Sure, absolutely. NeighborhoodScout.com serves about 1.1 million people per month. And it basically is a storehouse for and a search engine for a lot of our data. There's close to 400 different statistics and variables for every neighborhood in the U.S. You can type in an address and instantly get a report that tells you about the neighbors and demographics, real estate, including trends and vacancy trends, prices, and rental values, public school quality, crime rates, and more information about any location. We do it for states, cities, and individual neighborhoods, seamless coverage across the U.S. But it also has a search engine component to it that allows investors to build the ideal neighborhood that fits the profile that they're looking for investment. So they can choose any combination of characteristics from about 360 different characteristics. So they can choose as few as one or as many as 360 in any combination they like to find neighborhoods that best match their investing ideals. So you could say, show me the neighborhoods within 25 miles of Phoenix that have gone up the most in appreciation rates in the last 2 years or 1 year or last quarter or last 5 years, and show me those places that have a median house values in this range that I'm interested in, that have a declining vacancy rate, that have an increasing educational attainment, and have low crime.
Very interesting. Now, let's just talk about vacancy rate because, you know, of course, institutional apartments, there are many people surveying institutional apartment complexes and their owners for vacancy and rent studies and things like this. But vacancy data on single-family homes is just notoriously unreliable, in my opinion. Where are you getting that information, and how good is it?
I would say that it's so-so. What we do to try to fill in the gaps a little bit is we do a meta-analysis across lots of places that have similar characteristics all around the country. Take a look at what their reporting is from via the government with regard to vacancies and come up with a more stable index and indicator of vacancy rates and vacancy trends. That is, there's many things that will help you predict what the vacancy rate is today, and you can find those places that lines up with what the expected should be and those places that are outliers. And oftentimes the outliers mean that there's a data error, and we can correct that and fill it in by modeling a fill-in variable value for it.
Okay, so where do you even get vacancy data from? I mean, utility companies? See, that's not really reliable because, first of all, when a house is vacant, you know, most of the time someone like a property manager or the owner is turning the utilities on in order to show it and, you know, keep the lawn watered and, you know, keep the vandals out maybe with lighting and so forth. And of course, utility companies, they handle it differently. You know, some have like investor landlord accounts, some don't. It's just not reliable. The census, I think, is the most reliable determiner of vacancy rates, but you know they only come around every 10 years, of course. What are you using? Where are you getting the data in the first place?
Right, the raw data that goes into our models actually comes from the census data, but there's something that happened a few years ago with the census that allows us to update this every year. That is what's called the American Community Survey. So the census data goes around and censuses everyone or tries to census everyone every 10 years, but mostly that's limited to how many people live in this house. The American Community Survey now does a sampling of the population with a long form with lots of questions, details questions every single year, and they provide data on a moving 5-year window. So in the sixth year, they will drop the oldest year and include the newest, and they keep moving that 5-year window. So you have new updates every single year based on a sampling of the population rather than on everybody. And that provides more up-to-date data. Once we get that in, we use a meta-analysis and statistics to take a look at how every place is performing and try to model out some discrepancies in the data at particular locations, and then take a look at these trends over time and vacancies and educational attainment and income and what have you, right down to the sub-zip code level.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. I honed in on the vacancy rate thing, and I just want investors to understand the reason I kind of honed in on that. Of course, I want to talk about a lot of other things with you, is because, you know, when you look at vacancy rates for single-family homes, no one, when one of my single-family homes, you know, is a rental property that I have, is vacant, no one calls me up and says, hey, is your property vacant or occupied? You know, are you raising your rent or reducing your rent? Or, you know, no one surveys individual houses like that. But they do it with institutional apartments, and that's why the larger apartment complexes, you know, you can get some decent data on. The single family market, you just, you know, it's as we just discussed. It's, you know, so-so, like you said. But you do some things to try and mitigate that and make the information better. So where would, okay, so first of all, the things that you mentioned, like educational attainment and, you know, prices going up or down, what do you think an investor would want to use? I mean, you gave that example, but, you know, it kind of begged the question also, if you want to look at areas in the example you gave of, you know, that have had the most appreciation within 25 miles of the city center of Phoenix, maybe that area is already too highly appreciated, right? I mean, by the way, I also want to make another mention, you know, I am not a market timer. I've just never had good luck with that. I don't know anybody who can do it reliably. And I've been in this business a long time. I've interviewed a lot of experts, and, you know, they all think they can predict the market based on their certain number of factors until they fall on their sword and they're wrong. You know, so I just like to invest for cash flow. I like linear markets that just kind of chug along, produce nice cash flow, and do their thing. But if I could predict the market, boy, I'd be a lot richer than I am. So I wouldn't mind learning how to do that if it's possible. But you know, like in that example you gave, a highly appreciated market, would an investor want to gravitate toward that market or avoid it because maybe it's already had its run, right?
It really depends on what we think is the headroom that place has from where it is now. A lot of places have already had their run. Some places you've already missed a big wave, and what you'll get is a little trickling and increase over time. Some places that aren't really going up in value much can be wonderful cash flow opportunities because the purchase doesn't cost as much relative to the value of the rents you can get. You know, towns that have been good examples of this for a long time are places like Buffalo, New York, which has a huge university, but the real estate values aren't really trending higher very much. And so people can buy an apartment building and rent them out to people going to the University of Buffalo and do well.
So what else would an investor want to look for? And then, you know, let's talk a little bit more about the mechanics of actually using your site, maybe a little more. So I think it's a great resource.
Some of the key variables that are important to maintaining value, including in rental values over a long period of time, are crime. So you want to look for places that particularly have lower violent crime rates, if not lower total crime rates overall. It's very useful for people to see. It's an integrative measure of a lot of things that are going on socially in a location that can help say that you're going to protect the value of that and perhaps even have a lower vacancy rate for your particular property over time than places that have a little bit of more what we sometimes term social disorganization in the community. Another component of it that a lot of people don't think about is the quality of the public schools. Whether you have children in school or not, whether you plan to live in part of the building that you purchase or not, or whether it's purely for investment purposes, public schools oftentimes buoy the value and make it worth more for people to rent if it is two or more bedrooms, and people tend to have children that may be school-age children, you can get more for the rent for those places. And time and again, the places that tend to bounce back well after a downturn in the economy or to maintain their values longer are places that have good schools. We did a report with the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago titled One Anecdote to Foreclosures or Good Schools, where we looked at five metropolitan areas and took a look at the flow of transactions and properties at different school districts within those metropolitan areas and saw that basically the school district quality was one of the biggest indicators of whether they would have a lot of foreclosures or few foreclosures.
So how do you deal, and like, by the way, I agree with you, you want the best schools you can get, but the problem is that the better investment properties, you know, that have really good metrics and cash flow, you know, they don't have the kind of schools that people would demand out of, you know, what investors, you know, middle, upper middle class, wealthier investors would demand out of their own neighborhood where they live. So I find that, well, kind of two problems on this subject. We have a lot of clients that live in expensive markets, like California, where I live. I live in Southern California. You know, we have investors usually that are living in these sort of high value markets, but they like to invest in the lower price markets that have sensible numbers and aren't so speculative. And so they'll compare, you know, their school in Newport Beach, California, their school district where their kid goes, and then they'll start looking at a property in the suburbs of Chicago or Atlanta or Memphis or whatever, you know, some of the cities we recommend, and they'll say, boy, these schools are terrible, you know, well, hey, you know, the house you're buying there is one-tenth of the value of the house in which you live, so, you know, you got to keep some perspective on that. Like, is there a metric on schools as to how good they have to be or how bad they can be to be acceptable in your eyes?
For investment property, it really depends on whether you're trying to rent out to people who have school-age children or not. But typically, I would say that you would want to be above average for the metropolitan area or the state to provide those values. California, Southern California in particular, is notorious for having to pay the most money for the least quality of schools of almost anywhere in America. So, you know, it's very expensive.
I agree with you. Yeah. I think we're up to, what are we up to? Like $11,000, $12,000 per year per student. And you know, we've got all these public schools operating as jail schools, basically. They're, you know, they're like preparing kids for prison. It's unbelievable how bad they are. And I'm a product to public schools, by the way, and, you know, after fifth grade, I did private school before that. You know, we've got a stranglehold on the school system by the NEA, the National Education Association, that Steve Forbes, who was on the show, dubbed it the National Extortion Association. But lest I get too political here, so we need school choice in California. Okay, so, I mean, for a $60,000 or $80,000 single-family home, can you really expect them to be, you know, above the area or the state average, the metro average or the state average? I don't know.
It's tough to do. It's tough to do. Maybe in Arkansas.
Yeah, well, yeah. Little Rock's a pretty decent rental market. Okay, what else? What else would we look for? Tell us more.
Well, of course, as we mentioned, crime, schools, appreciation rates, if you're looking to hold on to it, but also you want to look at some of the demographics and information about the location. Are people particularly transient, not as transient? How educated it is? There are a few indicators that really tell you a lot about the location. The educational attainment of people, if they have, what percentage have bachelor's degrees, for example, will often tell you that people who have the ability to access information to make good decisions have preferentially done so and chosen to be in a particular neighborhood or market. That means that they're making decisions based on whether they have good access to high-paying jobs. They want to be there even if they don't have children. They're willing to pay rent for those locations. And they will tend to have lower turnover rates in your rental properties. The higher the educational attainment is, as long as not a lot of the people are currently attending college, as those turnover rates can be quite high in those markets. But you can see.
Well, but then that's a different strategy, right? That's like you mentioned Buffalo or really any college area. You know, you get the higher turnover, but you have those student rentals, and all the students are pretty hard on your property. They do have great cash flow. that's like a different business, you know? And I don't know, you know, a lot of the rental properties that just work so well, they're in such blue collar neighborhoods. I can't imagine you're going to go here and see too many bachelor's degrees, much less master's and PhDs. You know, I remember I used to live in Irvine, California for many years. And I remember once years ago looking up some demographics and psychographics on Irvine, which is in Southern California, very expensive city, you know, constantly voted or ranked by the FBI as one of the safest cities to live with population over 100,000 people. And I always jokingly said that, you know, Irvine is such a safe city that you'll never die. The only problem is it's so boring you may never actually live in the first place. Sorry, Irvine listeners. I know we have a lot of you, but I lived there, and for a single guy, it was pretty boring. But, you know, if you're married and you got kids, it's a different angle, different story. What was I saying about that? So, yeah, that, you know, I remember looking at Irvine, and it was like 16% of the population had PhDs, I think. I mean, I couldn't believe it. You know, highly educated, very bright people in a place like Irvine, but you couldn't make a rental property work to save your life in that city. You'd buy a $1 million house, you'd only be able to rent it for $4,000 a month. I mean, that doesn't work in a million, you know, in a zillion years, you know. So in these blue collar neighborhoods where you buy a $100,000 house and you rent it for $1,000 a month, I mean, how many bachelor's degrees are you going to see in these neighborhoods, right?
To some degree, you're correct. But I do think that there is a tipping point where you get down to a neighborhood where you see 6% of the adults have a bachelor's degree. And that tells you that you're basically in a whole different economic strata where people are probably struggling pretty hard. A lot of the bachelor's degree kind of oriented locations would have 15, 20, 25 percent, even 30% have a four-year college degree. Now, we're not talking about people who have MDs and JDs and PhDs and master's degrees, but they're basically teachers, police officers, firefighters, that kind of thing. So it's a more stable kind of demographic. A lot of police officers and firefighters now have four-year college degrees, and those are the kind of people who are working jobs, and they tend to be a more stable place for rentals, too.
Yeah, I would agree with you. You know what's interesting is the paradigm on college has really changed in the last decade, especially, I think. What's kind of interesting is if you look at the age of those bachelor's degree holders, for example, if it's a Generation Y person who's 35 and under, you know, and they've got the college degree, that person is saddled with massive student loan debt versus the person who's, you know, 35, 40 or older and they've got that bachelor's degree and they've either, you know, they went to school when college was less expensive, although still outrageous because it's, you know, gone up at you know, 2, 3, 4 times the rate of real inflation in many cases, you know, and if they did, you know, have a lower price college experience, they've, you know, probably paid off that student loan debt by now, by the time they're, you know, 35, 40 years old, hopefully. So it's kind of interesting, like you look at the college degree issue, and I would think that maybe, you know, if you've got a bunch of Gen Y bachelor's degrees, that it might almost be a negative because they're so oppressed by debt. You know, everybody's complaining about their student loans nowadays.
How did that happen? How did we get to be a society where all the Gen Ys decided that they were going to amass debt that was many multiples of what they could expect to earn when they first got out of college?
I would like to answer that question for you. This is a little bit of a tangent, but my listeners seem to like the tangents. My opinion of how that happened is it's largely the government's fault because they, you know, insured the student loans through, what, Sallie Mae, right? And that just flooded the market with money. And all these universities they started hiring PR firms and marketing agencies and branding agencies and building resort-style college facilities with, you know, huge gyms and beautiful dorms. And, you know, the kids would come and tour there and think, wow, I want to come live in the resort. And, you know, we just moved away from academia and the real concept of college. It's terrible. Had the government never flooded that market with money by insuring the student loans, And it's the same thing with real estate, by the way. I don't give real estate a pass. You know, with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, it's really the same deal. Okay, I think real estate is artificially expensive. I think college is really, really artificially expensive. At least real estate's got some tethers on it. College doesn't seem to have much of a tether at all. And they got a bunch of 18-year-olds to sign student loan contracts they didn't understand. And they didn't even think that those debts are never dischargeable in bankruptcy like other debts. It's a pretty sad story, if you ask me. Yeah. Thoughts?
I think so, too. And what even makes it worse is that some of the schools don't provide a good education, but take the government's money and put it in their pocket and walk.
Yeah, of course. And we got professors that work 12 hours a week, you know, that never get fired and don't have to compete in the free market. And, you know, look, you got a PhD, so you're familiar with that world, of course. It is what it is. But the question is, how do we react to it as investors? Okay, so crime. Do you want to tell us any more about the crime aspect of it?
Sure. A couple of quick things. First of all, Neighborhood Scout is a platform that has lots of data and brings it all together in one place. So you can basically type in an address or a name of a city or state, and you can get a report for the immediate neighborhood right around an address that will tell you a lot of information all in one place. And you can zoom in, you can look at Street View, you can see the whole thing. It's very powerful, very useful search engine, and also a fully comprehensive report. So it's useful for that. In regards to crime, we have seamless national coverage of crime data. There isn't a piece of terra firma, a GPS coordinate, or an address in America for which we do not have crime information. So it's very useful. And we did some work at this. Sometimes we put out stories to help people get their heads around this, about the 100 most dangerous cities in America and the 100 safest cities in America. And, you know, in preparation for this call, we took a look and arrayed those things against those cities, against median house values in those cities, and took a look at this. And one of the interesting things that came out is that from that we identified quickly the most expensive, dangerous city in America. Can you hazard a guess?
Oh, that's a good... Okay, let's try to...
This is the place where you're going to spend the most cash
to
buy a house in a place that you have to be careful walking around.
Okay, I'm going to take a stab at this. I have no idea, but I'm going to take three guesses. Don't tell me until afterwards. I'm going to say that's going to... Well, no, I got to take four guesses. I got to say... Okay, you want the actual city or the metro area? It's got to be either L.A. or like Oakland, California, or New York, Chicago, maybe Washington, D.C. Okay, I got like five in there.
No, that's
but
good.
Look, there's like 400 I could have guessed. So the odds, you know, I mean, you got to give me five. It's less than one. It's just 1% practically. Okay, tell us.
You guessed it. It's Oakland, California.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Oakland. You are the place that is the most expensive, dangerous city in the United States. Median house value about a little over $700,000 to be in a dangerous place.
So the reason is, of course, Silicon Valley, those, you know, super rich Silicon Valley techies are expanding and gentrifying Oakland, but I guess it hasn't quite happened yet. Yeah, right?
Right. It's still, you know, the first people who move in the waves of gentrification aren't as sensitive to crime as later. It would be the last people to move in under gentrification tend to be families with children, and the single people or single males or what have you will oftentimes put up with quite a bit of risk to move into a place to save some money.
Oh, interesting. You know, it's like that guy working for Google that lived in the van, or he's still living in the van, I think, out there in the parking lot to save money. But yeah, it's just ridiculous. You know, the Silicon Valley spectrum, it's crazy. Okay, well, what else can we know? If you want to talk more about crime, feel free. But just anything else in general that we can use. And I want to ask a little bit about your work with the Federal Reserve and the government in terms of like fair housing issues and things. Make sure we get that in before you go, if we could.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things interesting is that you can say, why would people spend so much money to buy in Oakland and live in a higher crime area? And the reason is because relative to the choices one has to live and work in that area, it is much cheaper. In fact, one of our safest cities in America is in the Bay Area also, Los Altos. And the median house value there is about a cool $2 million. So a lot different. And Saratoga is a nice cool $2.25 million. So it's very expensive, and Oakland is the $700,000 deal. But we took a look at this, and some of the things we do is forecast crime risk changes 5 years into the future. We try to find a place that's pretty high crime now, that has some good indicators for reduction in crime, and take a look at it and see if it's a pretty good price relative to other places around. And we found an interesting neighborhood in Berkeley, California, that looks like it's on Derby Street in Berkeley, which is currently, the crime risk there is about 2.5 times the national average. But it looks like it's expected to go down, we expect it to go down quite a bit over the next 5 years to be relatively safe compared to other parts of that area. And it is still $709,000, the median house to buy in there, but Berkeley, California overall is almost $1 million. So this is about 28% cheaper, and it looks like it's getting safer quickly. So those are some of the places that we can look at and say this may be a place for somebody has an opportunity to look into a neighborhood that is on the mend.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, good.
Berkeley, California, and some of the most safe places in America that are inexpensive to purchase into are...
These are the ones we want to hear about. We want to hear about $100,000 houses in great neighborhoods. Like, that's what I want to know. Yeah.
Well, one of these is, just because you go all around the country, one of these inexpensive and safe places is Bella Vista, Arkansas, which is just outside of Bentonville, headquarters of Walmart.
Oh, yeah, right. And what do you want us to know about that? Anything else, or is that it on Bella?
It's a retirement area on a bunch of man-made lakes with golf courses on the edge of Bentonville, and it's very inexpensive relative to how safe it is. But there are many places like that. You know, there's Zionsville, Indiana, outside of Indianapolis, but it's based really on the market that you're in. It's less expensive to live in Indianapolis than it is to live in the Bay Area, so you can get a very nice community there for a lot less money.
Very interesting. Well, I just put in my zip code here in La Jolla, California. The median price is $2.3 million. Wow. I wouldn't buy any rental properties here because that $2.3 million house is only going to rent for maybe $6,000 a month. It's crazy. Yeah, this is interesting. That's the challenge, to find high-quality, low-price neighborhoods that are not only high-quality, low-price, but they're moving in the right direction because the trend is a big deal. I mean, look at what happened in, you know, areas like South Beach, Florida, right? You know, that area wasn't so good years ago, but it got a lot better and it got really expensive. You know, that's one area I can think of. Of course, there are many examples of that. I'm looking in my neighborhoods, and it says it rates some special character things, like one is hip and trendy. It says 89% of the people. Am I one of those? I'm hip and trendy. Urban sophisticates, 98%. Walkable, 83%, quiet, 43%, and nautical. Oh, I guess let's go sailing, 99%. What does this all mean? You know, like, what are those things?
Yeah, Jason, those are multi-metric measures of data that help us kind of get a sense of the cultural character of a place. What's it going to be like to live there? What kind of character is involved there? And those numbers, they represent a 0 to 100 scale of the percentage of neighborhoods that it is more of that characteristic than. So what did you say that your neighborhood is for rated for urban sophisticates?
98.7%.
Great. So that means that you have, it's more of an urban sophisticate character in your neighborhood than 98% of the neighborhoods in America.
Okay, so that's a high number, right? We're very sophisticated over here. Oh, behave. Yes, okay. Okay, I got to ask you a question I bet you rarely get asked, okay? And I hope you don't mind us going a little long because you're so interesting. Being single, I would like to know, and I've read articles like this, you know, Forbes magazine does it every year. They rank these things, but their thing isn't good enough, I don't think. And, you know, Men's Health magazine does things like this. You know, where's the best place for a single guy looking for a wife to, where's the best place for me to live? You know, we want single females. See, like my area here in La Jolla has actually, it's slight
slightly more male. It's 50.6% versus 49.4%. And then when you start breaking things down by age, it's not good because, of course, any expensive area, the population generally gets older. I guess Silicon Valley could be a little bit of an exception to that. But then that's all male up there. You know, it's like 70% male up there. It's crazy. You know, can you find me the perfect place to live? I'd like to know that. Listeners, this is good. For those of you who are single, this is perk up. Listen to this.
Gosh, I'd have to use the search engine to find these places. But let's see now. You would want single females who...
Yep, ages 32 and, you know, 25 to 30. Let's go 25 to 35. Okay. You know, I can get into like hair color and everything if you'd like me to, but I don't think you do that.
I'll have to get back to you on that, but I probably would come up with a few answers for you.
Well, you know what's interesting? The largest demographic that isn't really considered a demographic cohort, yet at least, in the last three presidential elections was single Americans. Because that's, you know, all ages, both genders, all races. Nobody considers that to be a cohort, I guess, yet. Do you consider it to be a cohort?
I think I would.
Yeah. I think it's its own demographic, okay?
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, the site, in terms of subscription, I mean, there's a lot of data that's free here. Then there are some things that you need to subscribe to. How do the subscriptions work?
Right. So the subscriptions basically open up all the data, the richness of it. And about half of our subscribers are real estate investors and appraisers. And you can get a month-to-month subscription for about $39.99, or you can buy and commit to larger time periods for discounts. So, for instance, if you pay by the quarter, the three-month period, you get 3 months for the price of two, and it renews at that same rate every quarter. Or you can subscribe for a year for basically half price. You get the year for the price of 6 months, and it renews every year for that same discounted price.
Fantastic. Before you go, how does the government and the Federal Reserve use your data? You talked about Federal Reserve using it, and I think our listeners would be interested in knowing that real quickly.
The Federal Reserve contacted us because they were doing some work with one of our real estate investment trust customers on looking at, and they haven't revealed all the details of what they're doing, but they really wanted to understand and do some statistical analysis on school quality and crime risk and how that relates to real estate investor behavior.
Interesting. And what about the fair housing angle? What's going on there?
The fair housing angle, that's such an interesting question for us because we provide all kinds of data and analytics, but many states provide tax incentives to builders for building affordable housing. And what was happening in some states was that the affordable housing was being built in areas that may be described as ghettos or troubled neighborhoods. And some of the states, so the state of Texas, I think, was sued over this and recently lost their suit at this level of the Supreme Court. And so to stay in line with the Federal Fair Housing Act, they decided that they were going to turn to get objective data to make sure that when they were providing tax credits, incentives to build affordable housing, that it was going to be for affordable housing being built in what they considered good neighborhoods. And they used Neighborhood Scout as a resource in their published data for where people should turn to put in the data and information on the crime risk at locations as part of their application for the tax credits. So people come to Neighborhood Scout, get the information, and realize whether that's the place that will be allowed to get the tax credits or not. Similarly, in New York State, they use it for the school quality rating for the same thing, for the allocation of tax credits for affordable housing. It has to rate as a school, according to Neighborhood Scout, where the district is better than 75% of the school districts in New York State to be eligible for the tax credits for building affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, too. The Obama administration is really getting strong-arming this now. It's not just the old stuff it used to be, but they want to really engineer neighborhoods now and hold these subsidies from the federal side that cities and states get. They want to kind of hold them hostage. I mean, it's, I don't know, that feels too much like social engineering to me. I don't like it, but you may differ with me on that. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that it's so hard for us as a country to be able to compete if too many people are sitting in the carriage and not enough people are pulling. So I'm a big advocate that everyone should get out of the carriage and strap in and pull in the front. And that means everybody should have an equal opportunity and shot, but they should have to work and do their best to get there. I think that people need a good opportunity, but it doesn't mean that it should be equitable at the end based on inequitable efforts. So I really believe in a meritocracy, essentially. Everyone should get up to bat, and everyone should have a fair shot and fair swings, but if you don't hit, you should need to sit back down.
Yeah, I agree. So equal opportunity does not guarantee equal results. Good stuff. Well, the website, of course, is neighborhoodscout.com and also locationinc.com. I think that's more of your corporate site. And just any closing thoughts, Andrew?
Well, I will contact you later with the best place to find your bride-to-be, and maybe in the future we'll be able to discuss great places to retire.
I love it. Sounds good. Andrew Schiller, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye.
You know, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Penny, because Jason actually has a 3-book set on creating wealth that comes with 60 digital download audios.
Yes, Jason has that unique ability to make you understand investing the way it should be. It's a world where anything less than 26% annual return is disappointing.
I love how he actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I also like how he teaches you to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered at a savings of $94.
That's right. And to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series, complete with over 60 hours of audio and 3 books, just go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.